the album The Stranger. We were going to actually throw in a piece there, scenes from an Italian restaurant, but we have in fact an Indian restaurateur in studio now, Mr. Mike Butt. You're very welcome, Mike.
Thank you. Thanks, Charlie.
Now, Mike, just give us a little bit about your background in the industry. You came to Ireland from Kenya, I understand, sometime in the 50s.
Yes, sir. I came in 1949. In fact, before coming here, I just had a cup of coffee with my host of then, a friend that I met in London, an Irishman who invited me to Dublin for a week's holiday. The spring show was on, so I remember distinctly arriving at Dunleary on the mail boat after having a very terrible stormy crossing, half sick and dying, and Joe, my friend, received me at 6 o'clock in the morning, took me home to Santry where he lived. And 18 months later, I was supposed to be here for a week, Charlie. 18 months later, I was still living in Santry with Joe. And we just had a cup of coffee. We're like brothers. Well, that's why I'm in Ireland, because I met lovely people like Joe and a lot of host of other people who made me feel so at home that it's still an extended holiday. And I've had great fun.
And did you go into the restaurant business fairly quickly after your arrival?
No. I did all sorts of... I was involved in food because my main interest was in cooking. And we did a lot of industrial food. I'm responsible, I might tell you, Charlie, and a lot of people may not know this, and I know that I court the wrath of many a mother in Dublin when I say that I introduced the infamous or famous ice lolly into this country. It was not known until I marketed it here. I didn't continue pursue that for very long, but the restaurant business subsequently, it seemed timely that the type of food that I was used to cooking and that I was brought up eating would find favour with the Irish palate. And in 1956, I opened the first Indian restaurant in Leeson Street, the Golden Orient.
Mm-hmm.
It started up as an upmarket restaurant, but very quickly the public dictated the tone, and nobody understood Indian food as such, except there were a few. Luckily for me at the time, there were a few retired ex-Indian army people, retired servicemen who'd served in India, and also Indian civil service ex-officers who had retired, Irishmen who lived in Ireland and who had retired. But mind you, all of these people now were at a ripe age, as I am today myself. And so it was a thin market, but they remembered. I remember them coming in. I remember colonels and majors of one brand or another coming in and asking me, said, "Mr. Butt, would you give us a curry like we used to have in Pune?" And they would bring friends along, and they'd insist that these friends should be given curry as hot as you like. So it was fun and games, and I made a living at it as well, Shari.
And the Dubliner took to the hot, spicy curries fairly quickly, perhaps?
I found the Dubliner very adventurous, even then in 1956, although people weren't travelling as much. But they did, yes, certainly. I found after 3 months, I opened a restaurant which had 6 tables and sat 26 people, and after 3 months, I found that I had to extend and at least double the capacity. The expansion was that rapid, and people were taken to curry that quickly,
mm-hmm.
Which I was very pleasantly surprised. Incidentally, I might add that they're taking to what I'm doing in Sandymount happily, just as quickly.
Splendid news, splendid. Tell me about the general situation there in the restaurant business. Of course, the ingredients for your cooking. Did you find it difficult to get, say, certain vegetables, perhaps in Dublin in the mid-50s there?
Well, they were very, you know, apart from the basic root vegetables, there was very little else in vegetables. I remember a very beautiful, very lovely vegetable shop in Grafton Street called Knowles. Senior citizens like myself may remember it. You were too young then, Charlie.
I might have remembered it, Mike. I think I'm not as young as people think.
And there were two old girls in Knowles who knew every vegetable under the sun. They were the experts. And I used to go in the afternoons to do my shopping for the restaurant there. And I wanted to do some stuffed peppers, the green peppers called the capsicum. And they said they could get me peppers, but they'd have to be brought in from Covent Garden. So I said, is that a very difficult, tedious problem? They said, no, we're getting lots of things from Covent Garden, and next week we'll have the peppers for you. So I got my peppers the following week, and I purveyed them to a few of my customers, and ate most of them myself because they were very difficult to sell at the time. But I'm happy to tell you, Charlie, that I think that they were the first peppers that were brought into Ireland, as far as I can historically tell, because I often, the girls told me that they had never handled them before, mm-hmm. and that nobody else handled them in Ireland. More happily, it's nice to know that today, even downstairs here, if you go through the scarecrow that I came up to you through, there's a fine array of peppers, all Irish grown.
That's amazing, really, because I noticed them in all the supermarkets now. You have the green peppers, the red peppers, and the yellow pepper there as well, I think.
That's right.
All yes. grown here now.
Yes. Well, people love peppers now, and it's nice to think that one has been associated with something that is a sizable industry today.
Mm-hmm. Leading through the various years then, of course, up to the present time, would you find now that the Irish housewife, the Dublin housewife that you would be dealing with now, of course, now that you're proprietor of the new Spice Centre and Delicatessen in Sandymount, the marvellous shop there, Brown's on Sandymount Green, does the Irish housewife now, in fact, have quite a vast knowledge of spices and peppers and that sort of food now?
Oh, yes, indeed, Charlie. It's very encouraging, and people come in to me. We offer a service where we mix the spices for you for most things, particularly Indian food, and personalize them to your own taste. And if you want something classical, we have all freshly milled herbs that we prepare and mix there. And I find ladies not only from Sandymount. The other day I had a couple from Kildare. Last Saturday I had a couple all the way from Kildare. Mind you, a lot of these people are old disciples of mine who discovered I was in Sandymount. And of course they came looking for curry, but we don't sell curry in Sandymount. We sell the spices for making curry, because I think it's time now that having taken out of society by way of selling curry, I think it's time I put something back into it. And it gives me always gives me great pleasure to assist the ladies when they come in with any information that I can impart by way of explaining the usage of different spices. Because, cooking is a joyous thing. It's a thing of joy. And there are lots and lots, and I'm pleasantly surprised. Sandymount is full of ladies who are very interested in cooking. And not only ladies, but it's full of men who are very interested in cooking. And they come and they do the shopping, and the scene has changed completely. I think life will be even more pleasant from now on, shall we?
Well, certainly I must develop that one with you now, because earlier you heard me mention there to Carl Hazley's lady mother there, who was peeling potatoes for today's lunch. Is there anything we can give her now at this hour of the day, 11:47, well before lunchtime, I might add? Anything you have there, in fact, about peeling the potatoes, or
oh, yes.
anything at all there we can give her in the line of a recipe that she can cook up for Carl?
Oh, yes, yes, potatoes, yes, especially, when I walk through the scarecrow, there's lovely baskets of fresh, new potatoes. I've even seen new Irish potatoes there. So let's talk about a quickie on with new potatoes.
Right.
Something that'll take all together. It's, did you say, it's 12:15
That's
there.
Right, just about 12:15.
Well, it should be ready. It should be on the table by 12:15. Now, if you take a few new potatoes and slice them, wash them and slice them about 1/4-inch thick slices. Wash them and dry them in kitchen paper. And washing is necessary because you remove surplus starch from new potatoes. Having dried them in kitchen paper, now dust them with a little bit of cayenne or chili pepper. Now, if you don't like cayenne or chili pepper or hotness like that, well, use a black pepper mill, but it does do something to the dish. You don't have to make them fiery hot or anything like that. Then a pinch of ground nutmegs, and I'm sure most people have. Everybody has ground nutmegs in the kitchen nowadays. The third spice to use on it is a pinch of turmeric, which is the yellow spice that goes into curry making. Now, this dish is not a curry dish, but it's a quickie on potatoes, which I remember used to have to make. My mother who taught me to cook would say, well, let's have a potato snack, Mike, you make it, and I'd go into the kitchen. I'd love being told to make it, and this is how I used to make it. Dust it with salt, And then grease your pan with a little oil, vegetable oil, preferably sunflower oil, because it's healthier for you than most others. And spread your potatoes in the pan. If you have a heavy-bottomed pan, it'll do the job better. And then cover the potatoes with a lid. You can borrow a lid off your, if your fry pan hasn't a lid, you can borrow one off your saucepan. And allow these potatoes to gently fry in this pan, very gently. They're not to be cooked fast, in order that they would cook in about 20 minutes' time. Now, halfway through that, you, with a fish slice, you turn the potatoes upside down. And when you turn them upside down, you will find that the top, as you see it then, will have turned crisp. Now, these potatoes are supposed to be crisp top and bottom. The second half of the potatoes is done with the lid off, in order that the crispness retains, because if you leave the lid on for the second half, they will get soft and soggy again. And while I'm talking, you should have the potatoes sliced, and in another 15 minutes, they'll be ready to eat on the table.
Splendid. So Carl Haseley has something to look forward to today. So Sylvia Haseley, carry out those instructions immediately and look after that good man when he comes home. Thanks very much, Mike. Anything else there in the line of the recipe sheets at all, in fact, that we might have for the moment? Any special one now that you would people to try?
A lot of recipes, Charlie, in my head, but I scribbled a couple here which I thought may be of interest. One of them, I do not claim to be my own, but there's a very charming young lady from Iraq who lives in Sandymount, who came into the store the other day, and we talked about cooking, because she's very interested in cooking too. And then we have a lot in common in Eastern spices. And in fact, she came looking for some Eastern spices, but I asked her about certain things, the way they were cooked in Iraq, because I'm always interested in talking to people who cook different things. And she told me about a fish dish that she cooks, which sounds absolutely delectable. And I've taken her recipe, and I haven't asked her permission, but I've modified it slightly so that it becomes translatable and it becomes easy to use for the average Irish housewife, because I think that's always important when you're giving foreign recipes to native people in any country. One shouldn't put any mystique in it. You should take the mystique out of it in order that people can readily and handily use the recipe.
Of course.
I do not believe in recipe writers who have a self-importance and try to make themselves so important that the poor housewife who's trying to cook the thing is totally confused.
Mm-hmm.
Recipes should be given in the simplest format, and I'll try to do that with my friend's recipe.
Certainly.
Now, I should call it a baked fish with or without stuffing. So let's eliminate or decide whether it's going to be with or without stuffing. You can choose your own stuffing. I would use a little bit of, if you have a little leftover rice, add some raisins into it and put a few herbs into it, which whatever your favorite herbs are, a little oregano or a little hottish spice if you like, or whatever. If you have a few grapes lying around the place, throw a few grapes, a couple of orange segments, or anything in fact that you feel like putting into a stuffing. And if you put things like that, it becomes more adventurous, because the conventional stuffing made with bread, it's all right, but you should try to expand on that. However, you decide what stuffing you'd like to put into this fish, okay? Then the fish itself, it can be as simple as mackerel.
Mm-hmm.
It can be as expansive as a large cod, or anything in between. But for heaven's sake, keep away from whiting, because whiting is a fish, it's not a favorite fish of mine, and it's a fish that one can impart very little to in my repertoire of cooking anyway. So let's say you take a piece of cod or a mackerel. Have the fish gutted out for you, if you don't like doing it yourself, and then insert the stuffing in it, and then score the outside of the fish on both sides with a sharp knife, and then get some fresh tomatoes, which are very, very lovely at the moment. Say to a 2-pound fish, get a pound of tomatoes and chop them up coarsely, roughly, a good fistful, and I mean a fistful of nice, lovely, fresh parsley, a clove or two of garlic, and if you don't like peeling garlic, you can buy tubes of garlic now. Add a little bit of that to suit your own palate, as much or as little as you like. A little bit of finely chopped onion, minced, or if you have a one of those machines that does abracadabra and pulverizes everything, put it through it for a few minutes, and mix the whole lot together, salt and pepper, and just pour this mixture over the fish, and let it stand for about an hour in the refrigerator. It'll improve it if you let it stand and marinate for an hour, because the juices will permeate right through the fish, and that is the whole beauty of this particular dish. You then remove it to a preheated oven, gas mark 5 or 350 degrees if it's an electric one. Don't cover the fish, put it in the center of the oven and let it bake slowly there for about 40 minutes, 45 minutes or so, and it should be lovely golden crust tomato on top. Take this dish out and I promise you it's a feast for a king.
That sounds absolutely great, and I'm sure there'll be quite a few kings in Sandymount today.
This recipe, Charlie, is, as I said at the outset, a modification, or a slight modification, because there's a couple of ingredients used here that are not available in Dublin. For instance, pomegranate seed juice and that sort of thing. And I hope my lady friend will forgive me for omitting that in her recipe. I've made a slight modification, but I know it's I can taste it now, right now, yes.
And of course, the reason for the modification, of course, as you say, to make it as simple as possible for the would-be cook to prepare and to understand and to get through the various stages of preparation. It certainly sounds a magnificent dish. Tell me one thing, you were talking about fish there, Mike. Any anecdotes at all about the fish situation when you came to Ireland first? Anything that you in fact found perhaps wasn't eaten and is now probably quite popular in restaurants around Dublin?
Oh yes, Charlie, yes. You see, in the 30 years or so that I've been associated with food and with people directly, I came across, you know, there were some very interesting things happen. There's a fish today that's very popular, a very prime fish, and quite expensive fish now. It's, some people call it angler, and some people call it monkfish, but it is a very lovely fish to eat. It's one of these fish that were discovered not many years ago, because fishermen started fishing at a lower level than they did heretofore in the sea. They went deeper down into the sea, mm-hmm. and down there they found different species of fish. And this is one of those fish. Not all of those fish are very good table fish, but this particular one, I happened to be in Moore Street, and this, as I told you, I used to go to Knowles in Grafton Street for vegetables, and I went to Moore Street for my fish and poultry. It was great fun going into Moore Street to shop. It was like going to market. And in Moore Street, I used to pick fish out of a great big crates of fish that came into the fishmongers. And they were a mixed bag of fish. And here one morning I saw this quite grotesque looking thing with a great big antenna over its head. And it was all head and no tail and no body. So I inquired of the lad in the shop as to what this fish was about and who ate it and what was it called. And he said, "We don't eat that thing. That's like an animal out of the sea. It's horrible." I said, "Well, you know, it looks horrible, but sometimes things that look horrible can be very nice to eat. Do you not sell it? Is it not sold by anybody?" "No, this is a stray fish. Once in a while, one turns up in a net and they throw it in the box and here it is." "And what do you do with it?" I asked. He said, "We chop it up for the cat." So I said, "I'll tell you what you do. Would you mind if I had that fish, would you skin it for me and let's have a look at the flesh of it?" So we stood together on his bench and we opened this fish up, and I can tell you, out of about, say, 6 or 7 pound weight of fish, we got about 2 pounds or thereabouts of edible meat off it. This is the nature of the beast, you see. Mm-hmm. And I brought this fish back to the restaurant and tried it 2 or 3 different ways, and I found it beautiful, delightful. It reminded me of a fish that's very famous in the east, in the Indian Ocean, the east coast of Africa, where I was born, Charlie, as you know, and where my grandfather, incidentally, was a fishmonger, and he had his own fisheries. And this fish is widely known in all of eastern Africa, Mauritius and the Seychelles Islands, as kingfish. And it looks like a tuna or a swordfish, with this big long snout like a swordfish, and it's delightful to eat. And this monkfish reminded me of the flavor of the fish I ate as a boy. So, of course, I took to it straight away. And I started hounding poor old Mrs. Kelly, who was my fishmonger in Moore Street, for more of this. And she said, "But we'll get it. If it comes again, it doesn't. It's only a stray one that comes." Eventually, they started collecting it for me. And I was hard pushed to give them 3 pence a pound for it, because I wanted to buy it, because I wanted to encourage them to get me a regular supply of it. Now, they wouldn't do that if I didn't insist that I want to buy it.
Because
it's got to be, you know, in business, there's got to be something in it for everybody.
Of course.
And I was trying to give incentive to them. Well, they continued to find me a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more. And suddenly, the fishermen started bringing this fish in. And today, it's on in every restaurant of any name or any caliber or any fame serves angler fish in one form or the other. And it's a very expensive fish.
I've noticed that, certainly.
And a lot of it is shipped out to... I saw it in Rams. I was visiting Champagne a few years ago, and I saw it sitting in a fishmonger's in Rams. I suspect it's Irish. Like, I know that a lot of squid, Charlie, and sea ursin, which is sea urchin, is fished in Cork. I know for a fact that a lot of the fish that you eat in Spain, a lot of squid that you eat in Spain, is Irish squid.
Amazing.
And it's fished in Irish waters. Very happily, people are going to Spain a lot now and coming back with the taste of paella and zarzuela and all kinds of Spanish things. And people don't mind eating squid. In fact, a lot of people like eating squid.
That seems to be very true indeed. And of course, certainly, that's one great boost that the cooking industry has had from, I suppose, its ancillary industry there, the tourism, foreign and home tourism. And that's certainly great to see indeed. Mike, but we've run out of time. It's been fascinating listening to your expertise there, to your recipes. I'd like to certainly take this opportunity to thank you very much indeed for taking the time. You're a very busy man. I know you, in fact, cancelled a few things to fit us in here this morning. Many thanks, Mike, for coming in to talk to us this morning on Radio Sandymount.
Charlie, it's my great pleasure, and it's a privilege to be addressing the ladies of Sandymount. I would just like to say that as long as I'm in Sandymount, if I can assist in any way to help you cook something in a little different manner, a little more exciting, I'd be delighted to see you all.
Mike Butt, proprietor of Brown's Sandymount Green, the Spice Centre and Delicatessen. Thank you very much indeed. Right, Mike Butt and myself will now, in fact, leave you with Mr. John Murray and Spectrum, and he'll take you through till 1 o'clock.
For first-class value for money, come to Bellamy's of Bowles Bridge. Bellamy's for superb lunches Monday to Friday, not forgetting the best brunch served in town on Sundays between 12:30 and 2 o'clock. Good food, good drinks, and above all, good value. Bellamy's of Bowles Bridge.
There's a lovely surprise waiting for kids at H. Williams. Their very own Collie Dolly. There's a whole range of them. You get one when you collect 10...